If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks, for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the divine love and light of the Most Radiant One. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Ashtar Command, Cosmic Pep Talks for Closet Christs. So, our topic tonight for our seminar is Attitude Adjusts Altitude. So let's take a deep breath and intend the integration of your higher principles, your divine awareness, your monad, your soul, into your physical body. Course yourself as living awareness down into the self. Activate and enliven all the way down to your toes. Yes, that heat, those chills, those tingles, that's you inhabiting this biosphere. Take another deep breath. Infuse yourself with a living fire of divine awareness. Expanded bliss, and inhabit fully this moment, this place, this body, this time capsule. Yes, that rocking is often the reaction of the attunement. Learn to observe what it feels like as you access and integrate consciously your higher awareness into your physical body. All of this is about training you to walk 24/7 in spiritual awareness while you live an extraordinary, ordinary life. It's not departing from any facet of life that we master ourselves. It's in entering into the mouth of the bear, so to speak, and learning to operate at the optimal attitude and altitude at will. The altitude of your attitude is what adjusts your vibrational spectrum. It modulates and moves with the positioning that you take mentally and emotionally. And with regard to your overall attitude. For example, even a thought of loving, compassion, or a desire to serve, or to engage in service in a way that's selfless and benefits another, causes the immune system to become stronger. Even watching others engaged in selfless and noble acts that benefit humanity, boosts the immune system. And just the opposite if you watch negative things. It's interesting that the media seems to be filled with people hurting and harming and abusing other people. Could that be the ego's agenda operating through the lower self of those in media? Seeking to lower the vibrations? I think so. I refuse to watch anything where a person is being abused or anything is being abused. And that's just exercising wisdom. So just let's reflect for a moment back upon your day. So far, what have you noticed about your overall attitude Were you able to stay conscious and aware? Were you able to maintain a consistent altitude of awareness, proactively directing yourself in positive ways? How did your week go? Overall, would you say you enjoyed your life this past week or today? That has very much to do with the attitude that you approached your day or the situation, and the altitude at which you adjusted your attitude. Learn to think of attitude as vibrational state and adjust it accordingly. Were you able, at least in some instances, to simply observe rather than to identify with your actions? How high were you able to maintain your altitude, your vibrations, your state? Have you acquired a reference point for when you are simply observing yourself acting? And when you are watching yourself from the vantage point of spiritual awareness? These are those little exercises that we can do that enable us to begin to experience conscious awareness and self-mastery. We get on top of our lives. We begin to exercise the vigilance of a self-actualized person. So have you been able to experience yourself as the observer of your human personality as it goes through whatever it does in the day? And which level of yourself do you tend to most identify with? Your human enchilada? Or you as the divine spirit inhabiting this human biosphere? You are the conscious awareness, participating with your human personality, and yet aware that your human personality is only a temporary role you are enacting. And you're enacting this temporary role through this body-mind expression that is much like a character on the stage of life. So the challenge is to awaken as awareness, apart from your physical form and personality. You know, as a soul having a human experience, your very first job is to establish a relationship with your human body, mind, personality. And then your job is to see that this relationship of you as soul with your human personality develops and leads to marriage. So the two levels, spiritual and human, need to romance and marry and become as one. So when your personality in the world comes into alignment with your higher divine purpose, your real life begins. And all the preparatory work was like a rehearsal for the main performance, which begins the moment that you, as a divine spirit, take charge of your life. So it's really a process of directing your choices in alignment with your higher nature and recognizing that higher nature and also that part of you that doesn't want to align with a higher self. That part that resists is the false self. So you learn to recognize that part of you that doesn't want to do the higher thing, and you don't act on that impulse. And you recognize the part that does want to cooperate with a divine plan, and you do act on that. and every choice produces consequences. And so we need to be willing to accept responsibility for the choices that we make and their consequences. There's no avoiding the two. So wisdom comes from learning from your choices and facing their consequences. And when the personality comes into alignment with the soul, for the first time you really begin to access true authenticity and power. That is so important because people want power without authenticity. And falsehood is never supported. In fact, every form of deceit forfeits divine aid. So when you're functioning out of a false sense of self, the ego really is left hopping on one leg, barely hopping on one leg, for a limited period of time. So gaining altitude in adjusting your attitude is a skill that you need to exercise consciously. You need to be aware when you're operating at a lower frequency band. And when you sense that lower nature, which vibrates in the level of resistance to just about anything that's true and wonderful, that part of you that just wants to give in to the lower nature and to heck with a higher self, your challenge is to gain altitude. And the gaining of the altitude and the adjusting of your attitude raises you in vibration to a more positive state. And this is where you can exercise every day the practice of being aware of those pulls of your familiar ego patterns of negativity and resistance, reactiveness, self-indulgence, addictive and self-destructive habits. We all have areas where we operate at a lower level of vibration. We all have our particular areas of temptation and weakness, our Achilles heels, if you will. So the thing to notice here is that the lower the rate of vibration that we operate at, the more miserable we'll feel. Feeling bad is simply an indication that you're caught up in a lower rate of vibration. And this lower rate makes you feel heavy, dense, lethargic, apathetic, so forth. And the higher the rate of vibration, the lighter, happier, freer, clearer, and more vitally alive you'll feel. So it's important to be aware of exactly how you're feeling. What are you feeling in your body? What are you feeling in your emotions? In your mental state? In your overall sense of yourself and your well-being or lack of well-being. So as a research scientist in the laboratory of your life, your task is to find out what to add and what to eliminate from the components of your life. Working, living, speaking, teaching, interacting from your highest level of light attainment is what we're looking at here. The consistency of choosing consciously to move to the highest choice, the highest action, the highest thought, the most quality response that you can give to the situation or the person or whatever you're involved with. That is what we're aiming at here. And as you can see, this is a continual expansion of divine awareness. It doesn't have like a goal to it. But it does become fun and a game in the sense that each day you can run the objective observer over your daily activities and see how consistent you can maintain divine awareness, that you can make really wise choices so that you're not driven and run by events and life situations, but again, you're on top exercising conscious self-direction in alignment with your spiritual objectives. As you observe yourself in your actions and reactions and your feelings and your awareness and the choices you make or don't make, you come to learn what causes you to operate at the highest level of efficiency, which also means the highest rate of vibratory frequency. But do bear in mind that this applies more to your attitude than to your actual physical state. Some of you, for any number of reasons, may be physically limited in some way due to karma, health, age, disability, whatever. Treat it all as grist for the mill and as what is right and appropriate for you at that particular stage. It's part of the research assignment that you've undergone in this laboratory of your life. So don't judge any of that as being wrong or inappropriate or feel frustrated because you have an issue that really needs to be addressed. And sometimes that issue becomes the whole, scenario around which your human life revolves. That would certainly be the case of someone who was blind, for example, or had a serious disability, or a challenge in some way where they couldn't do much more than deal with their condition. That is your mission, if that's your case. In your interacting with a hospital or other personnel, professionals, in the arena of your healing, or addressing the disability, you are bringing light and transmitting higher codes of awareness into that hospital, into that institution, into that particular arena where many other human beings are suffering terribly because they don't have that higher awareness. So that may be your assigned arena. So we're not looking here at physical perfection. Nothing in the physical world of form is perfect, but you as the spirit utilizing forms for a divine purpose. You are the only perfection in this world. You as the purity and holiness of your divine spirit made in the image and likeness of God. So don't seek for perfection in the outer world of form. That leads to disappointment. If you want to be disappointed, then have an appointment. If you want to have your expectations not be met, have expectations. So we're exercising spiritual practicality here. Don't look for things where they can't be found. Or try to work a system that's designed to have an obsolescence failure built into the system, which is everything the ego tries to do without God. It's going to fail. It's built into the system. Only God wins. Get it? God's in charge here. So your spiritual integrative process is extremely intricate and complex, and many energies and factors need to be taken into consideration. But I would say this, that overall, the task of adjusting the different vibratory rates of your subtle bodies and coordinating their interface with your chakra system and the chakra system with the endocrine system of your physical body. And all of that synergized with the cerebral, spinal, sympathetic, nervous system. All of that is in the hands of your spiritual upline. The master, the angels, the teachers, the benefactors, the guides that work with you spiritually upon the inner planes, and sometimes in the physical, not always, sometimes in the physical, it's their dharma, their duty, to adjust your vibrations at each level according to your highest good and highest rate. In fact, in the caverns of Shambhala, in the Himalayan range, you will find a particular area where they have small figurines called teraphs. And the teraph, T-E-R-A-P-H, the teraph reflects your particular vibratory rate and coloration in a mini form of you, so that the master can go into that cave, look at your teraph, and adjust the frequencies within that mini you, if you will, mini replica of you, and also ascertain how well you're progressing with the integrated process. I've been in, through soul travel, into some of those regions in the Himalayan range in Shambhala, and I've physically seen many of these things that I describe. And that is how they work with you very often. Just know that you're never left alone in your spiritual development. And know this, that the more advanced you are spiritually, the less physical contact you're going to have with your upline. That may sound like an oxymoron here, but it's not. The more evolved and matured you are, the more you are free to exercise your burgeoning, your budding mastery. Like a mother, you know, she doesn't watch you and how you walk when you get to be a teenager. She doesn't sit and tell you how to run your life or any of that when you're grown. But the little child that's just learning to walk, I mean, the mother's right there, you know, in case the child would fall, protecting it so it won't get hurt. So apply that to your spiritual life. Don't seek for a phenomena that belongs to the spiritual kindergarten when you are more evolved and advanced. Likewise, don't look for phenomena in the astral realm where you see a lot of things. The higher you go, the less you're going to see in terms of the phantasmagoria that inhabits the lower astral realm, that is full of imaginative thought forms and scenarios. Those are all the thought forms that people project in their wishful thinking and their fantasizing. And those are part of the tests that come forward for an advanced soul. You learn to be detached from desire for phenomena. You learn to walk in the light of your own divine awareness, your own divine certainty, your own divine self-actualization. And you learn to walk as a divine being, fully embodying your life. So you don't lean on phenomena. You don't get upset if the master is silent. I hope that makes sense to you, because so many people get very upset because they don't have experiences, they don't see Ashtar, they're not beaming up on the ships, at least they don't think they are. But we try to get you very grounded in your body so that you can go beyond those levels. Those are baby things. Those are the things that amuse people when they haven't really gotten serious with fully awakening and taking responsibility for their own levels of awareness and mastery. So We can best cooperate with our process by making the wisest and most aware choices possible in how we live and what we incorporate into our lifestyle and adopt as our habits. Those habits are really hard to break if you don't nip them in the bud, if they start to be a bad habit. And you can change any habit pattern if you could adopt another approach for a minimum of 21 days. That seems to be the magic number to break a habit pattern. But it takes, you know, it really takes your desire to exercise, your conscious choice and awareness. And there simply is no one formula or size that fits all. That is why you, as a consciously aware and observant person, are the best one to discern what works best for your system and nature. And I think it's really helpful to observe the lifestyles and habits and patterns of successful people who are functioning at their optimum best, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I think a really good example of that we have in the world today is Tony Robbins. And that's his field. That's what he teaches. But he certainly would be operating at his optimum best with what he's got going for him at this time. And you can observe the Olympic athlete, or the thoroughbred horse, or the graceful cheetah. Each entity, when it's functioning in its natural and best element, has an ease and a grace and a flow. There's no efforting to that. So discerning your true vibration, your rhythm, your nature, your harmonic way of being, when you are true to every level of yourself, notice the ease and the comfort that comes, the genuine comfort that comes from being one with your divine, true nature. It is bliss, and it is effortless. For example, in a simple little thing about your diet, you'll notice that some foods make you feel light and energized, whereas other foods may make you feel dull and heavy and lethargic. Pay attention to that. We learn, for example, that drinking alcohol causes the brain to dull. And it begins, if you observe, with a numbing sensation at the back of the head, at the top of the spine. And this negative effect, this numbing effect, adversely affects the speech, because the throat chakra is located back there at the top, the base of the skull, the back of the throat neck area. And because the alcohol adversely affects the speech, enough alcohol causes the speech to become slurred because the nervous system was affected. And that also affects one's coordination. That's why one staggers and loses control of the motor system. Drink enough and you'll get sick and throw up. And behave irresponsibly and feel awful in the morning. Have a hangover. What part of intelligence is doing that to yourself? And so you learn through experience and observation how to make choices that lead to greater awareness, greater health, greater vitality, greater abundance, greater well-being on every level, because they're all connected. You start one area and begin to focus upon making that as optimal as possible, and there's a bleed-through effect on every other area of your life. We all know that if we start a health regimen, for example, we join the gym and we start to juice or really look out for our health, that begins to affect how we feel about ourselves and our attitude in every other area of our life. So pick one area. You know, you don't have to address everything. Keep moderation and balance in place and common sense. But pick some area of your life and see how you can improve it. And notice how that begins a beneficent energy that ripples through every area. And you learn how to make choices in alignment with your higher divine self and your soul's purpose, and to let go of those habits, associations, and behaviors that are not in alignment with your higher value and purpose. You know, sometimes you have to let go of your past to move into your future. So be aware of those that are hanging on from a period and a time in your life that you have long since outgrown. But those people, situations, habits, events, arenas are still trying to hold you back in that old form. Be aware of that. You'll notice that when you get back into those areas, you'll feel a dropping of the energy in your solar plexus and in your heart. You'll feel like a thud. Get out of there. You're not going to build vibrant life in a den of darkness and death. Choose life. Choose vitality. Choose the highest vibration that you can get yourself surrounded with. And keep advancing and raising and raising and raising. People and things and events will jettison off you like, you know, those stages fall off a rocket when it goes into orbit. And you have to just accept that. That's part of the spiritual path, is that you outvibe and outgrow people, places, things, associations, groups, spiritual practices, jobs, whatever. That's part of the spiritual path. It's part of the path of detachment. It's part of the path of acceptance and trust. As you allow the divine momentum of you as an inhabiting spirit taking over your life to enlarge your arena and to make room for you, your life has to be worthy of you, of your presence. And the things that are not worthy of your presence must depart your presence in some way. So again, be at peace, be at ease, be in the accepting of what is going on in your life once you've made that divine commitment to work, live, teach, be, manifest, speak at your highest rate of vibration, your highest level, and allow the divine to rearrange your life as it wishes. And as an aside here, it's useful to remember this fact, that the longing to be, whether it's to be free or enlightened or to ascend or to return home or to be anywhere other than here and now, that longing does not come from the true self. The soul is whole. Or you could say, the soul, the spirit, is holy. It's whole within itself. It doesn't have that longing to be. So it's not about longing. It's about embodying as best you can your highest rate of vibration. It's about inhabiting your life fully. It's about occupying yourself, your arena of influence, and coming present with it, full on. So all conflict and complaint and resistance to what is here and now comes from your false self. And the ego, the false self, is the lowest vibratory part of your expression. So when you're vibrating at the level of ego, you tend to vibrate at a rate that attracts other egos. And that's when you encounter a lot of really gnarly relationship things that go on in your life. It's like our weakness attracts the weakness in others, our darkness the darkness in others. Just as our spirit, our light, our vibrancy also attracts that in other people. If you address, for example, a person out of the negativity of the ego, you'll call that forward in the same response from that person. Unless, of course, that person is very highly evolved, in which case they won't respond at all. Now, if you respond with loving from a centered place of divine conscientiousness, you can expect to have a positive interchange with that other person as well, because you'll evoke them at the level where they're evoking you, generally speaking. So the true self that you really are has no sense of urgency whatsoever. So that thing that drives you to find your mission and to catch the next flight to Venus or whatever, that's not your high self. That's your crazy monkey mind. So there's never any imperative to do or to achieve or to accomplish or to arrive at any destination, because the soul is already that which is eternally established in the eternal beingness, awareness, and bliss. It doesn't need to go anywhere to do anything to manifest what it is. The true self is awake and alive, and it's present with life here and now. And it's enjoying when it's in you and incorporated and married with you as a personal self in the human body. You and it are enjoying every moment. You're smelling the flowers. You're enjoying the scenery. You're having fun on the train ride. And you're learning from every person, every experience. The truly aware person can be taught by everyone, regards everyone as the one beloved teacher. And so that part of you is receptive to whatever is imparting. That part that resists, that doesn't want to hear, doesn't want to pay attention, that's not the true self. That's that false self again. So the true self doesn't have any barriers, doesn't have any blocks. It lives from the place of being, the all in all, as all it is. So it's a life lived from a sense of wholeness that we're looking at here. A life lived from inner contentment and certitude, led by trust, and yielded to that which is. And full of gratitude. Your whole life becomes a paean of praise. And every cell in your body praises God. That's a true life. That's a spirit-filled life. That's a spirit-led life. And thus it is that one is living in the kingdom of heaven with God at all times, including right now, in this moment. So where is it that one would want to ascend, or go, or be, if heaven is here now, and it simply involves an adjusting of the altitude of one's attitude? How simple is that? It's the ego that has created religious doctrines and have-to-dos and laws and do this and do that, and makes it very, very complex, because again, the ego's agenda is to keep you seeking and becoming, but never finding and never arriving. So once you bust the game of the ego, you don't pay attention to it anymore. You know that it's a liar, and the only language it can speak is lies and falsehood. So you learn to ignore it. It's going to dissolve into the love of your divine awareness. So that's a good thing. Everyone wins when God is in the driver's seat. So it's living life absorbed in the beauty of the divine presence, which the more you keep company with the beloved, the more you're married to that divine beloved, you begin to see that divine beloved shining through every face and every form. Because the true self sees and experiences only that in this world. Oh yeah, it sees forms, it sees behaviors, it sees what is. It isn't like blinded. It isn't less vision. It's just that it sees beyond the distortion to the true image and likeness of God that is only slightly veiled to the fully awakened person. So it's like, it's not like you don't see what's there. You just look through it and beyond it to the truth. And you're not fooled by the outer charade. And know also that the false self is actually fed and sustained by negativity and resistance. And negativity and resistance actually are the same energy. So that oppositional negative self is actually kept in place by exacerbating conflict and opposition to whatever is present. In fact, you can use this as an exercise. If you want to catch and really experience the vibration of that false self, the next time you or another find yourself in a position where your whatever, your point of view, your right to be who you are, your position, whatever, when that is confronted by another in a negative way, and you notice that energy come up in which you want to defend yourself or give that person a piece of your ego or lose it and just go off on them totally, that feeling, it comes up from the pit of the stomach, it's like a knot, rises up in, like a knot in your chest. It's like some big hand just grabs your heart and squeezes. You feel a contraction. That's the false self. And practice, if you can, it's an acquired skill. Practice not reacting. You're going to want to. You're going to really have to fight the urge not to. But that desire to be right and to win at the expense of another is the false self. That's the ego. And it takes two egos to create conflict. So whichever ego is the more conscious and aware, or not the ego, whichever soul is the most conscious and aware of the ego has to take the initiative to not respond, not react. Don't lend energy to any kind of an oppositional scenario. Just don't go there. Don't participate in conflict. A Course in Miracles said, would you rather be right or happy? Well, most of us would rather be right. Thinking that's going to make us happy. No, it just creates karma, which you later feel really bad about and have to clear. That's the truth. The other thing is that you can absolutely count on it that the ego of yourself or someone else is going to make every attempt possible to disrupt your composure, to invade your sense of inner stillness, to offend your sensibilities, by creating some kind of disturbing, distracting issue, something to contest and argue about. I was reminded of while we were visiting Sai Baba in India, we when we come back, we all have these funny stories of how all of the ego-driven momentums of nature really conspire to disrupt your meditation. You'll have like squadrons of dive-bombing mosquitoes. You'll have bed bugs that come out at night. You'll have annoying roommates. I remember one time I had two very rowdy New York girls from Brooklyn who were assigned to my little cell. And in the ashram, you have a little, an 8x8 cell with a little hole in the floor for a bathroom. Some of them have Western toilets. But in those days, in the early days, it was really primitive. And you'd have a window that's open with bars on it to keep the monkeys out, but barely, because they can still reach through the bars and get whatever you have on the ledge. But anyway, you basically have a cement floor And anything that's that you sleep on, you have to bring with you, like a mat or a sleeping bag, whatever. So here I am with these two gals who would sneak out to smoke, which was against the rules of the ashram. They'd come in reeking of tobacco, and they would use four-letter words in every sentence, and they talked nonstop. And they would stay out really late at night, going out into the village, which was again against the ashram rules. And then when they come in from the village, they would sit under that open window a few inches from where I was trying to sleep, and they would talk into the wee hours of the morning. And, of course, they wouldn't get up at 4 and meditate like me. I was a good devotee. So I was getting more and more upset, more and more angry, more and more frustrated. And I stopped meditating. I was just kind of sitting and sulking and feeling very resentful. And Sai Baba came inwardly to me and said, "But I put them with you so that you could be a good influence on them." I felt so bad. It was like, oh no, I've been like the worst possible example of a loving, you know, centered devotee in the face of this particular situation. But you can count on it. When you go to an ashram, every button that you could possibly have pushed is going to get pushed, because that's the gauntlet you have to go through, where every weakness is tested, everything that could possibly provoke your negativity to the surface is going to surface so that you can overcome it. The other thing that in my years of going back and forth to India, one of my trips there, I was with a mother that had two babies. One was a toddler and one was an infant. And both of the babies cried nonstop. They had diarrhea. They were covered with mosquito bites. But was I compassionate? Oh, no. I was trying to meditate. Talk about not being present with what's going on. So one morning, one of the toddler got up, and I was playing possum, you know, because I knew if I opened my eyes, the baby would be, you know, coming to me for comfort. And I watched the baby pucker up, get ready to cry. Poor little thing was covered with mosquito bites. And what he liked to do was sit on my luggage and poop. I mean, he had to poop, had diarrhea, poor little thing, and was a young mother who was very challenged in trying to take care of the baby under that kind of a primitive ashram situation that we had in those early days. So I watched the baby, and the baby stood in the middle of the room. The baby looked at me. I was asleep, or supposedly asleep, looked at the mother. The mother was asleep. The baby's little brother was asleep, and the baby puckered up to cry, and then you could see the baby shift the attitude into an altitude, and that tiny baby that was only about 18 months old puckered up and began to sing, Govinda Jai Jai, Gopala Jai Jai. I'll never forget it. That baby started to sing a bhajan in the middle of that misery that poor child was going through. And that really broke a lot of self-importance and righteousness and pride off of my ego. That was a very humbling trip for me. I remember the faith of the mother. It was very impressive, too. Her infant was extremely ill, and she had such faith. She knew that nothing bad could happen to her children. She was in the presence of the divine avatar. And so she didn't freak out. She had absolute faith. And we had a little doctor called Vijaya Lakshmi, who was, oh gosh, about four and a half feet tall, very, very tiny. And she had a little basket, and she'd make the rounds to we pitiful Westerners every day, offering sairams, not much else. She would always say, oh, Swami will take care, Swami will take care. And she'd give us a few little packets of the sacred ash, the vibhuti. And she'd say, just take that, everything will be fine, everything will be fine. Sairam, Sairam. She never gave any of us any medicine. I wasn't sick, but it was like everybody was so sick. And so this one little baby stopped eating, stopped drinking breast milk, but would consume a large package of vibhuti every day, would cry for the vibhuti. And after a few days, the baby was totally healed. So there were like miracles happening all around me and extraordinary things that were happening that were very much bringing my divine self more awake and more activated and more present in my body. I, as so many devotees, was coming to Sai Baba with the thought that, he will grant liberation. He will do this. He will do that. In other words, we had expectations and appointments. instead, he put his finger on where we had the worst, as he would call it, bhava rogya, which is birth and death disease. He'd put his finger right on that place, and he'd push and push and push. And we would squirm and squirm and squirm and complain. But, you know, he would pressure and pressure and pressure us until all the pus and vinegar and awful stuff would get out of our systems, and we would begin to emanate that sweet nectar, which was of the divine self that we truly are. But, boy, it was a process. And then the other thing, the monkeys would, I swear they would conspire. They would get together to conspire on how they could most agitate and irritate us. And their favorite thing was to reach the little brown hands through the grating of the window and grab our panties off of our makeshift laundry lines. And one time I watched two of the ladies actually coming to a fight over whose panties was whose. I mean, you find yourself doing the most extraordinarily crazy things when you're in that extreme circumstance at the ashram and under that heat of the volcano, that Sai Baba. And the other thing was that our laundry would be washed in the river by what's called a dobi. A dobi is a washer person, a person that does your laundry. And they wash it in the river, and it comes back really white, really clean. But whatever they wash your clothes in gives you this rash that's very much like poison oak. It itches like a thousand devils, and it gets all around your waist and wherever you have contact with your clothes, like your bra or your whatever. And that would make your life really miserable. And then very often there was rocks in the food. So when you would bite down on the rice or something, you had to be careful because unless you wanted a broken tooth. So there's all these wonderful little things. And the food, by the way, in the early days was fire and brimstone. It was the hottest. I can't imagine any human being eating that food for any modicum of pleasure. You couldn't taste it because your taste buds were totally stunned into numbness by the time you had finished chewing a bite of food. And that was the only food in the early, early days. That was the only food that was available. But, you know, after 2 weeks, your body adjusts and you love the food. I found myself absolutely craving it after 2 weeks, and I didn't notice it was hot. So the body adjusts. You adapt. You come into harmony with your environment if you don't fight it and resist it. Of course, I fought it and resisted it like everybody else. In my own way. I had a little different way of fighting and resisting than some of the others. But we all did our shtick, you know. We all did our ego numbers while we were in Sai Baba's ashram. And it was interesting, too, that we would sit outside sometimes and wait for hours to have darshan where Sai Baba would walk out. And then some people would have to get up and go pee just as Sai Baba was coming out. Or they would have diarrhea and they'd have to go run, try to find a latrine somewhere. So there was always this crazy drama going on with the physical bodies. I remember one time I was sitting and reading the lovely meditations of Yogananda. And in those days, they had lovely flowering trees here and there in the ashram. And I was sitting under one of them. And a large seagull flew overhead and relieved himself on my head, splatted on the book, all over my clean sari. I think I didn't say any expletives. If I remember, I just washed it off, wiped it off, actually, and kept on reading. So, got a brownie point for that one. But But the big brownie point for me came when I had been in the ashram for some time and I was beginning to get in contact with my higher nature. And I was sitting and reading, I think, Sai Baba's most profound book. And it's called Jnana Vahini, which is the stream of wisdom. And it's all about non-dualistic oneness with God. God is, all else is an illusion. That's the subtotal of that. It's called Advaita. And I had just been reading that book, and suddenly I realized, oh, I'm the same as Sai Baba. We're the same Atma. There's no difference. Whereupon, and I'm sitting all alone out in this blazing hot, sandy area in front of the mandir, the old temple, Sai Baba comes out of his door where he has his little room. He walks right up to me. He slaps the book with his hand and said, Acha, which means good in Hindi, and covered the book with that sacred ash, that Ubudi, that emanates out of his hands. And then he turned on his heel and went back into his room without saying anything else. But it was an acknowledgement that, yeah, right on, girl, you finally got it. That's it. There's one divine spirit, and we're embodiments of that one divine. And everything else, really, is just grist for the mill. It's window dressing. It's stage props. It's silly, goofy things, and things that go bump and scrape and bite you in the night, but none of it is to be taken seriously. The only thing that's important is keeping the altitude of your attitude adjusted so that that atmic awareness can awaken and dawn in its fullness and in all of its glory and magnificence. So I hope that's been a useful dialogue for you this evening. I had fun giving it. And let's go out chanting Anai Hu. Deep breath. Keys you can apply in adjusting the altitude of your attitude is whenever you find yourself in need of an attitude adjuster, sit down and slowly breathe and begin to chant Anai Hu. That's A-N-I-H-U. And it basically means in Hebrew, Ani Hu, I am He, or I am Divine, I am God, I am Atma. And allow that, the vibration of that sacred chant to raise your vibrations. It will bring you into complete accord and oneness with that higher resonant field that we call divine, your divine awareness, your divine self. And it's so easy to do. You can chant it out loud, you can whisper it, you can sing it as a love song to God, or you can just think it in your mind, but it will transmute the negativity of the lower self and bring you into divine congruency. So God bless you, and God willing, I will be with you this time next week. Adonai.